So welcome back to the Birdie Mug Pod,
episode 55.
Good evening. I'm saying good evening because it's a bit unusual for us to be recording at this time. You've shot up after work from Fareham.
Yeah, it's dark outside.
It's now dark outside, which is really sad because a month ago it was still light at this time. It's unusual for us to be doing an evening episode, but here we are.
I got stuck at the weekend due to roadworks on the M27 and I abandoned ship and drove home.
Yeah, that's so bad, wasn't it?
So here we are on a Friday evening.
On a Friday instead. And we just had a nice chilly.
Yeah. But no, lovely time to do a podcast, really.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit late, but not too badly.
Not too bad.
As always, it's good to be back. And we are back, not quite doing a species-specific, but not far off.
Not
it
far
is
off.
A specific group of
I'll
animals.
Give you a little hint, shall I?
Any excuse to press a button. But before we get to that, any catch-up? Because as usual, I've got nothing. I can do look-ahead catch-up in the sense that I'm off tomorrow to join up with friend of the pod, Josh, who's obviously been on for an episode.
You're going on a fungi hunt.
Yeah, we're going to go photograph some fungi in the New Forest. So that hasn't happened yet, but that's as close to catch-up as I can get.
Okay, well, I've got only catch-up really is had big excitement at Arundel Wetland Centre because we've had an osprey visit and it's been there actually quite a while now. It's been there since September. It's not a usual thing for an osprey to stop over. Obviously, they're a passage migrant, and they stop over on their way back to Africa. And one has stopped at Wetland Centre, which has caused a huge amount of excitement. But I've managed to get my first good picture of an osprey, which has been amazing.
It's a stunning photo as well.
I also couldn't let catch up go without just mentioning one of my absolute wildlife heroes and conservation heroes, passing away, Dr. Jane Goodall, someone that inspired us to do an episode. We did an episode about her, The Book of Hope, and I think I might have put it on a little post, but if you've never read that book, I urge you to go and read it. It's incredibly inspirational. As she was, an amazing lady. She's left an incredible legacy. I urge you to go and read her book. She's done many, but that one in particular was one that really inspired us.
Yeah,
it has. An incredible lady.
Yeah, it has obviously been a very sad time for anybody who's been into zoology or the environmental movement for a long time. It has been lovely to see all the incredible messages
come out
around.
There were so many, wasn't there? So many.
Also, people sharing her words and videos of what it was all about, and it's amazing to see how important her messaging still is.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, definitely. Absolutely. If you haven't read her book, do give it a read. And yeah, it's always sad when someone like that is
but what a legacy she's left behind. So anyway, on a cheerier note, let's talk about bumblebees.
Yep, all about the bumblebees.
So we're not talking about bees as a species, we're just talking about the bumblebee, which is a fascinating little creature.
Yeah, and group of creatures.
Group of creatures.
And this episode actually came about because of two things. Firstly, the Bumblebee Conservation Trust, and we'll talk about their citizen science a little bit later on, but the report that came out of it was sort of highlighting the struggle that bumblebees were having in the UK, especially the last couple of years. And so I thought, well, that's immediately a contender for an episode for us.
Yeah.
But also the Bumblebee Conservation Trust themselves have been struggling a little bit as far as, you know, financial difficulties and everything like that. So it was a really nice opportunity to showcase the incredibly important work that they do for such a remarkable group of animals.
Definitely.
And sort of dive into what's going on with our bumblebees.
You know, and it's one of those things, you know, I did it about dragonflies. We did a...
Are you now a bumblebee donator?
Well, I'm going to be. I'm going to join up. It's only £30 a year or something, and, you know, I feel like I need to. I just need another sticker on the car.
Yeah, I was going to say, you collect stickers on cars like Thanos and Infinity Stones.
A lot there. But it's an amazing, it's brilliant. I mean,
they're an amazing charity.
It's helping in any tiny way that you can. It makes a huge difference. So.
Yeah, and we'll go on to talk about their work a little bit later on. But first,
do you want to talk about Bombus?
Yeah, we should probably introduce bumblebees as a group of animals. So there's about 270 odd species around the world, which is, to be honest, more than I thought there were for bumblebees.
Yeah.
We have 24 species in the UK, including six cuckoo species that are actually parasitic bees, which is really interesting, and I'll talk a little bit about later on. But I thought I might as well start off giving you, I don't know, an idea of their evolution, as that's sort of become like my equivalent of the cultural corner, and talk a little bit about that. So They're thought to have evolved around the Himalayan area. They're particularly well adapted to deal with cooler climates and are therefore found in a more temperate region. And so that sort of really plays into their evolution. So bees in general, not just bumblebees, evolved from ancient wasps. A bit like modern wasps, they were predatory. They lived 120 to 130 million years ago. And a bit like, you know, our modern day bees, they still built big nests, these wasps. They, you know, defended it. But rather than being pollinators, they were very much carnivorous insects and predators. And so bees evolved from these wasps, but they appeared quite soon after the first flowering plants evolved.
Which makes a
lot of sense. So the early insects were obviously not pollinating anything because there weren't any flowers out there to pollinate. So they became sort of the pollinating insects. And at the start, they would have looked quite wasp-like. And then obviously there's all sorts of different groups of bees that have changed in loads of ways. But for bumblebees themselves, it's actually thought that during like the Himalayan mountain range formation, when the two tectonic plates, which I think my geography is going to be bad here, so the like India-Asia tectonic plate and the other one collided to force up the mountain range. Somebody with geography knowledge can tell me what other plate that was, but it was two plates that collided and made a mountain range. And so as that happened and it forced, obviously, increased elevation, the temperature in the region dropped quite noticeably. And so it was a period of sort of global cooling. And so bumblebees evolved, this is about 25 to 40 odd million years ago, during this time of cooling. And their adaptations, like a larger size, their really dense hair, essentially allowed them to survive the colder climate where other insects and other bees and things like that wouldn't have done. And that's really reflected in their global distribution. You see bumblebees in the sort of northern temperate regions much more than you do in the tropics or any of the hotspots. They haven't really spread to those parts of the world. And the vast majority of them are found even up in like the polar regions. You still get bumblebees knocking about up there.
And you're going to tell us why they're able to survive in colder temperatures?
Well, I mentioned their larger size, yes, which makes a... Basically, it changes their surface area to volume ratio. And so smaller animals have a bigger ratio and they lose heat a lot more quickly. There's more surface area for, in comparison to their volume, to lose heat. That's why things like little mice have a very fast heartbeat, because they've got to try and keep warm because they're losing so much heat. And so obviously them having a bigger body helps that. They also have really dense hair, which helps with thermoregulation. It traps the air and basically acts as an insulation.
A fuzzy pile-covered body.
Exactly. They are famously fluffy. And then they can also directly raise their body temperature through thoracic shivering, where they basically...
Thoracic?
Thoracic, because it's their thorax that does it. And essentially it's the flight muscles. They vibrate or shiver and it allows their body to warm up. It's actually really important in their life sort of cycle or their behavior in like the UK where it's cold and damp, and it allows them to sort of warm up before they take flight. And
thoracic shivering.
Indeed. I've got some other cool things about the morphology, but that's mainly their evolution. 25, 40 million years ago during a time of cooling, and it was these adaptations that allowed them to survive.
But you haven't talked about aposomatic coloration.
I haven't, because it wasn't relevant to the specific evolution. Would you like to?
I wanted to throw aposomatic in, because I didn't know that's what that means. It's a warning colour.
Yes.
So aposomatic, that's something I learned. It's a new word.
It's a good word.
I threw it in a bit early, didn't I?
It just sort of disappeared, but it's absolutely fine. But yeah, so that's like all bees, they would have come from wasps, but they obviously look quite different. I do love the fact that, you know, predatory insects were about flowering plants evolved, and then through a variety of very long process, which I won't go into, we then ended up with cool pollinating.
And of course, they became some of the world's most important pollinators.
Yeah, they did indeed.
In fact, they are.
Well, on their pollination, they've got something very cool called sonication, where they can vibrate at quite specific frequencies to dislodge pollen from the anthers of certain different flowers. And some of them are sort of tailored to different plants, and their sonication will vary depending on which plants they tend to specialise on, which I quite like the idea of them just vibrating plants so the pollen goes everywhere. Oh, that was quite cool.
Yeah, it's very cool.
So on their sort of morphology, we've touched on, you know, dense hair and things like that and big bodies, but the way they're grouped is quite interesting. So if you're a bumblebee, you belong to the genus Bombus, which is such a great name for a genus.
It means booming, or buzzing.
Yeah. And which, if you ever see it or hear a bumblebee, it's a very...
Hang on.
Bloody buttons.
I never need an excuse.
It's a very justified and well-earned name because they do create an incredibly distinct buzz or hum. And so we obviously mentioned that there's about 270-odd species, but within that genus of Bombus, it's split into 15 to 17 sort of subgenus or subgenera, depending on how you want to classify them. But it's typically based on morphology, tongue length, and nesting habits. I mentioned that we have 6 cuckoo species. They have a very different nesting lifestyle to the other 24 species that occur in the UK. But the other main one that distinguishes different species is the tongue length. So you get long-tongued species, such as Bombus hortorum, which prefer much deeper flowers, things like foxglove and clovers. And then you've got short-tongued species, like our really common Bombus terrestris, which is your common buff-tailed bumblebee that you get, which you see the most frequently in the UK. And they will sort of pollinate and visit much more open flowers, things like dandelions and brambles. So I didn't actually know until I did this research that tongue length was a distinct
feature. No, I didn't know that at all
either. Of how you...
There were a lot of things I didn't know about bumblebees, but they're also, you know, they're very different from honeybees, aren't they? Honeybees obviously nest in very large colonies. Yeah. Bumblebees don't. Bumblebees don't make honey, or very little honey, because they don't need to store food for the winter, because they don't live very long, do they? They only live about a year.
Yeah, so it's only the fertilised queens that hibernate over winter. The rest of the colony does not survive, which
is really interesting. The colony just works like stink and then dies off.
Yeah.
For the queen, obviously, and then dies off.
Yeah, so they're what's known as an annual eusocial insect. So
eusocial, that was another word that I had didn't know. Which eusocial, is just a colony that's formed with a single queen.
Yes, so things like ants were another example. A lot of the Hymenoptera species are. Hymenoptera being ants, bees and wasps are what you'd call eusocial. So you've got that one sort of queen and then lots of workers. And yeah, unlike honeybees, it's only the fertilized female bumblebee queen that actually hibernates from about late autumn to early spring. They choose a nice sheltered spot, normally interesting, just sort of loose soil or under leaf litter or moss or compost seeds is another really big one for them. And they just hunker down, and then when they emerge, they essentially just start a new nest and start a new colony.
And of course, the cuckoo bumblebees, who are their brood parasitic, they don't make nests at all, because or form colonies, because their queens just invade the nests of other bumblebee species, kill the resident queens and take them over. Obviously, that's why they're called cuckoo bumblebees.
Yeah, and obviously we've done an episode on the cuckoo bird. But their evolution is really interesting, because the cuckoo females will emerge slightly later than all of the host species, because they need the host to go and establish a nice nest for them to invade. And then they either kill the host queen or they will just dominate and sort of take over. They'll lay eggs within that nest's like brood cells, and then the host workers, just without really knowing it, rear all the cuckoo bee offspring, which
fascinating,
is
isn't it?
Really interesting.
I've got a little question for you, a little quiz question for you about cuckoo bumblebees. Would you like it?
Yeah, go on then.
How can you tell the difference between a cuckoo and a nest-making bumblebee? There is a difference.
God, you know what? I don't actually know.
You want to find out? So nest-making bumblebees can be distinguished from similarly large, fuzzy cuckoo bumblebees by the form of the female hind leg.
Oh, okay.
In nesting bumblebees, it's modified to form a pollen basket, a bare, shiny area surrounded by a fringe of hairs used to transport pollen.
Yeah, if you ever see bees with big yellow baskets of pollen, that's what.
Whereas in cuckoo bumblebees, the hind leg is hairy all round because they never carry pollen.
Oh, that is interesting. Mm. I had a friend at university called George who was a absolute bee enthusiast. His knowledge of British bees was incredible. And one of the greatest inventions I ever saw is he took, it was like a melon ball. It was like a pair of scissors with two semicircle cups at the end, which you're supposed to use for scooping ice cream or a melon, and essentially he would just go around, and that's how we would grab bees. You just put it over a shutter and then he could open it up, ID it and release it, and it was one of the most incredible things I've ever seen as far as a bit of ingenuity. Melon baller catch bees.
That's awesome. There are 24 species of bumblebee in Britain, which I think you already
mentioned.
And they're the following 7 are probably the most widespread. Would you like me to tell you what they are?
Yeah, wrap them off.
White-tailed bumblebee, a buff-tailed bumblebee, garden bumblebees, a red-tailed bumblebee, tree bumblebee, early bumblebee and a common carder bee. Those are the seven, probably the seven most common ones that you will see.
I think I could probably only recognise and identify the Bombus terrestris buff-tailed bumblebee. I think it's the only one that I'd be able to see and be like, I know exactly what that is. My bee ID is not particularly good.
And I didn't know anything really about cuckoo bumblebees or how to identify them, so... You know, you see bees flying around, you wouldn't know whether they're a cuckoo bumblebee or not, would you?
I did go looking for them with
but now you do know because you just look for the legs.
Yeah, with that same friend, actually, and a couple of others, I did go looking for cuckoo bees on Newburgh Beach on Anglesey, which was really good fun. And he, again, being an absolute wealth of bee knowledge, he could spot them quite easily. So back to the normal eusocial bumblebees. Obviously, I mentioned that the fertilised queens overwinter from sort of late autumn to early spring. So then... In spring, the queens emerge. It can be as early as February, but it can be as late as April, obviously, depending on the species. And she pretty much needs to find nectar immediately to fuel flight and warm herself up. She finds a nice suitable nest. Quite often they use old rodent burrows or things that are under sheds or even abandoned bird nests. And they build essentially a small waxy pot, which, funnily enough, is called a honey pot, even though the bumblebee nests are not that nice hexagonal comb like honeybees. They're much more just like this irregular, massive, waxy cells, with every cell holding multiple eggs, and the larvae sort of feed communally rather than that sort of neat, organised honeybee structure that we think of. And then, obviously, once she's formed and found her nest, she incubates her brood by shivering those flight muscles to make sure they're nice and warm, about 30 degrees. And then in early summer, it's what's known as the worker phase. The first workers will emerge after about a month, and then they take over all the foraging, all the brood care, and the queen essentially just becomes an egg-laying machine. And the colony expands to about 50 to 400.
Yes, it's quite small, isn't it?
So comparatively much smaller. But Bombus terrestris can reach 500 plus in good, healthy conditions. So there's still a lot of bees knocking about. It's just not quite honeybee standard. And then mid to late summer, the colony switches to producing males and new queens. Males leave to mate, queens feed heavily to build up their nice fat reserves for hibernation, and after mating, like we say, that old colony dies off as the weather gets really cold and the female fertilised queen goes off and hibernates, and it all starts again. So it's quite brutal, really. The whole colony sort of just dying off.
Yes, I'll say it's a very short lifespan, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I did think, and I couldn't work out when to fit it in, but I think I might just throw it in. Now this is a proper physics, and I don't understand half the words I'm about to say, but there is a very common myth surrounding bumblebees, and that is that they sort of disagree with the laws of physics and they shouldn't actually be able to fly because their wings are too small for the size of their body. And I hear it. I said to you before we start recording, I heard it on a random, not animal related podcast at all, just this week, that it's still a commonly held belief that they...
There's been an awful lot of things written about this, hasn't there?
I've seen it so often.
Me too.
So,
but yeah, do go on.
The calculations that reported to show bumblebees can't fly are based on what's called a simplified linear treatment of oscillating aerofoils.
Well, of course it is.
Which, I know the word oscillating. Essentially, the method assumes small amplitude oscillations without flow separation. So I think that means people were assuming they were flapping their wings a bit like a bird would. And I liked this. This ignores the effect of dynamic stall, an airflow separation inducing a large vortex above the wing, which briefly produces several times the lift of the aerofoil in regular flight. More sophisticated aerodynamic analysis shows that bumblebees can fly because its wings encounter this dynamic stall in every oscillation cycle. Essentially, that's a really long, wordy, physicsy way of saying that they move their two pairs of wings in like a figure of eight sort of motion rather than this up and down thing. And it creates this, apparently it's called a dynamic stall, but it creates a large vortex above the wing, which increases their lift capabilities.
Yeah, apparently it's more similar to a helicopter propeller than an aeroplane wings, you know, so it's that kind of
if you actually look, apparently, at the actual physics and look at the laws surrounding this dynamic stall and vortexes, and or vortices, I guess would be the plural, they can fly and they should be able to fly, and they're not doing anything against the laws of physics.
We know that they can fly because they do fly.
And generally things in the world obey the laws of physics.
I think it's only because in proportion to their appearance, they've got a big, fat body.
Yeah,
their wings are small. However, you know, there's a lot of fuzz and fur on that body, so they're not actually as heavy as they look.
I think, so if you take in physics properly, which obviously we do on this podcast, bumblebees...
Well, you knew what oscillating
exactly. Bumblebees are not disobeying the laws of physics. They conform to it like the rest of us, just through some very clever evolution of how they use their wings. So there you go.
So it's been proved absolutely categorically that they are not defying the laws of physics.
Do you know what? I was thinking throughout that entire thing what the word was, and I could not think of the word defying. It's just
I've just thrown it in, so that's good. I wanted to just do one. There was one little funny thing that I read about that on their lifestyle, and you talked about them foraging for food once the workers were hatched. They tend to forage at dawn and dusk, and they can travel a couple of miles to do so. I quite liked this little analogy of that. The returning bee may signal to his fellow workers that he's found a source of food by a series of erratic and uncoordinated movements. Honeybees do that. They'll go and waggle. And they do a comparison of that. If the waggle dance of the honeybee is strictly ballroom, because they do a very sophisticated one, the dance of the bumblebee is strictly dad at a wedding.
I was really interested to see where you're going with that, because I read that unlike honeybees, they don't give these nice exact directions.
No, it's very erratic and uncoordinated, like a dad at a wedding.
I feel like if you look at them, that sort of suits them.
I thought I did some good dancing at your wedding, actually, mate.
I don't remember.
No, you wouldn't have done that.
Actually, I didn't drink at my wedding. Not much, anyway. But that is besides the point. Before, because I realised we haven't even gone into decline or conservation, we've just got carried away with how cool bees are, it's probably time for you to do your little cultural reference.
Yeah, I've got quite a lot actually on, so I will try and whiz through.
Buckle in, it's time for some bumblebee culture.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of bumblebee culture and folklore. We'll start off with British and Irish. Bees are seen as wise and mysterious. A buzz at the window signifies an approaching visitor. A red tail bee suggests a male visitor and a white tail a female, so there's little myths like that. A single bee entering a house is often a sign of good luck, wealth, or a coming visitor. Conversely, a bumblebee dying in the home could bring bad luck or poverty. There are lots of traditions, particularly in Celtic traditions, it was believed that bees would carry news to the spirit world, and families would tell the bees about significant life events such as births or marriages, which I thought was quite cool. This one I really liked. In Old English, the bumblebee was called the Dumbledore. And J.K. Rowling?
I always say Rowling.
Chose it as a name for her Hogwarts headmaster because of his love of music. And the author pictured a sturdy figure meandering around the school corridors humming to himself, which is why he called him Dumbledore. Oh. Why she called him Dumbledore. So I thought that was quite cool.
I saw that they used to also be called the humblebee.
Charles Darwin called them humblebees, and that was a very common name for them in Victorian times.
Which I quite liked.
The pleasing descriptive genus Bombus was assigned to the bumblebee by a great French entomologist called Pierre-André Latriel, who was a former priest, and that bee's English name varied across the centuries. What else have we got? And, of course, there's a very, very famous piece of music called The Flight of the Bumblebee, which was composed by Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, which actually I listened to while I was doing this research. And it's
good. It's very cool. I've heard it a few times, I think.
What else have we got? One of the few cultural ones from film, of course, was Bumblebee from The Transformers.
When I googled Bumblebee evolution, the number of YouTube videos that came up about the evolution of the Bumblebee Transformer, and I was like, this is not what I want.
Known for his determination and willingness to sacrifice himself for others.
And so, infuriate me from trying to do some research.
In the military, the United States Naval Construction Battalions adopted the Bumblebee as their insignia in 1942. And of course, there are lots of sayings around bees, which I think I might have touched on our invertebrates episode that we did, Bee in Your Bonnet, which obviously came from bees being trapped in the hats that beekeepers wore, and they were making them very agitated and would absolutely monopolize your attention if you have a bee in your hat. So that's where Bee in Your Bonnet got it. It's something that you get obsessed by, and so that came from that. The bee's knees, that was, people would automatically think that's because they carry pollen on their knees, but it's not that, apparently. It was the origin of the phrase bee's knees is rather unclear. It was used in the 18th century to refer to something very small, because bee's knees are very small. Its present meaning of something marvellous might be a reference to the 1920s dancer Bee Jackson's active knees when she popularised the Charleston.
Oh, I mean, obviously bees don't actually have any knees, so it's quite...
No, well, yeah, okay. Do they not?
Well, they don't have kneecaps or anything like that.
No, they don't have kneecaps, but they do have knees. They don't have kneecaps.
Well, depends how you want to define a knee, I guess.
Yeah, well, is it not just a crease in the leg?
I guess if you, by that definition, fine. Yeah, they have knees.
Yeah. Okay. So, what else have we got? Busy as a bee. Obviously, that goes without saying. That was a saying that dates back to Geoffrey Chaucer, father of the English literature. First referred to this saying in a book called Canterbury Tales. You have other things that you take a bee line, and the bee line came from the 1800s in America. When they used to go and raid wild bee nests for honey, and they would trap bees in little cylinders and then release them and then follow them. So that bee line took them straight to the wild honey, effectively.
Yeah.
So they would then raid the nests for honey. So that's where bee line came from. And then you've got things like spelling bees, which I thought was really good. A spelling bee, which refers to a meeting of lots of people who work together, you know, like a bee.
Wait, no, it's a spelling bee, it's a competition.
Yeah, but a bee referred to a meeting of people who work together to benefit a group. And then the meaning was expanded to include various purposeful gatherings like the National Spelling Bee.
Yeah.
So that's where that came from. The birds and the bees. There's no better known euphemism for sex education than the birds and the bees, which dates back to at least the 1800s. And then Cole Porter immortalised the metaphor in a song. Birds do it, bees do it. Even educated fleas do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love.
Magnificent.
God, I've sung on the pod. I might have to take that out.
No, you have to leave that in, I think.
And then, of course, you've got a saying called the queen bee syndrome. And the queen bee refers to a dominant female leader of a group, more specifically to a woman who's achieved success in a male-dominated field.
Oh, that's
but then is critical of other women, a phenomenon called queen bee syndrome.
I've not heard that before.
No, which is quite good. So those are all the little cultural
things.
That's
really cool. They've permeated a lot of cultural sayings.
Yeah, lots of sayings, yeah.
I like that. I always enjoy cultural corn because I know it's the bit that you're researching. I don't actually look at it at all. So I end up learning loads.
Like the cultural and the folklore behind all of it because you'll virtually every species that we've done.
There's always something.
There's always something that goes back, you know, hundreds of years or back in tradition and culture and folklore and sometimes back thousands of years. Yeah, and I love that.
I mean, I think I've banged on about it a few times and I don't even know whether it predates us upgrading the audio equipment, but still one of my favourite episodes is our eel episode.
Yes.
Because I was absolutely blown away by the cultural impacts of eels.
Yeah, by the fact that they were currency. Yeah, was amazing, wasn't it?
You know, from entomology or zoological point of view, a lot of this I've covered at some point and I have to go back and it's not necessarily super new, but a lot of the cultural stuff is, and things like the history behind eels just absolutely blew me away.
Yeah, that was
again
amazing. Yeah,
every species we've done has had some sort of cultural impact, and I always find it interesting. Plus I don't have to research it, I just get to listen to it, which is really cool.
So we better go on, I think. Let's move on to particularly the UK's bumblebees are in crisis.
Yes. So we spoke at the beginning. I mentioned that we have 24 species split into the two lifestyle groups, the 18 social species and the 6 parasitic cuckoo bees. But we've already had 3 species go extinct. Callum's bumblebee, Bombus callimanus, which was last recorded on the Berkshire Downs in 1941. The short-haired bumblebee, which is Bombus subterraneus, which was last seen at Dungeness, is that how you say that, in 1988, and officially declared extinct in 2000. And the apple bumblebee, Bombus pomerum, which was only found for a short time on the south coast in the mid-1800s. So I saw that a while ago popped up, and it was just they're not recent extinctions, but I didn't even know that we had these 3 bumblebee species go extinct. But what really prompted this episode was the Bumblebee Conservation Trust does, a bit like quite a few of the charities we covered, a sort of citizen science initiative called the Bee Walk.
Yes,
and
great.
They do counts every single year, and people can get involved. And we'll talk all about that at the end because it's a great way of getting involved in bee conservation. But they posted an article saying that the 2024 counts were one of the worst years on record for bumblebees since the count began in 2010. And it's really, you know, quite concerning. Some of our really common species fell by really big amounts. Things like red-tailed bumblebees dropped 74% in observations, white-tailed 60% in some regions. And overall, this then led on to a whole article about bumblebee decline in a more general sense. And 8 of our species have contracted their range by more than 70% since the 1940s. And so it was this big report that came out showing that bumblebee counts were 25% below the average that was being recorded between 2010 and 2023, which is when this initiative has sort of taken place. And the decline wasn't uniform. Some are doing slightly better, some are doing particularly poorly, and the timing of it is all different. But the general message was that our bumblebees are struggling. And I thought, well, apart from the fact I needed to read a little bit more about it, it also opened up as a topic we should talk about, because we always hear about, oh, save the honeybee. And yes, that happens often, but we sometimes forget that all the other bees need a hand as well. And I think there's not a more charming group of bees than our bombus. And they certainly deserve a little bit of attention.
Yeah, and of course we're going to talk about the normal things, but one of the biggest things is that the UK has lost 97% of wildflower meadows in the last century.
Yeah, it's a huge impact.
And bumblebees basically are struggling to find enough food and nesting spots to survive. And so the habitat loss has come out of building new houses on meadows, fragmentation, which we've talked about so many times. This one I didn't know about, actually. Increased competition, too many honeybees and commercially reared bumblebees, which I didn't know about.
Yeah,
actually.
I added this as a separate category from the habitat loss, because it's interesting. I've seen it a few times, it popping up saying that honeybee, the popularity in beekeeping and people having, you know, their own beehives in their gardens, yeah. Or you saw randomly quite a lot of organizations or companies would start having beehives on the roofs of their office buildings, and it was sort of marketed as a good way to help our pollinators and do something good for the environment, and it was a really cool thing to do. And it's hard to say how much of an impact honeybee keeping on its own is impacting bumblebees, because obviously, and we'll go on to talk about the other things, they're being hit by all sorts of other factors, so it's hard to say that exactly what impact the honeybees are having. But in areas where honeybee cultivation is particularly strong, especially if the habitat quality is not particularly good, so they're already short on food, if you've got a whole bunch of people with honeybee hives in their gardens with thousands of bees, they will outcompete bumblebees, especially as honeybees are very sort of general pollinators. They're not too fussy. They'll visit all sorts of things, whereas quite a lot of the bumblebee species will have their own little niches. And yes, so those that require those little pockets of certain types of flowers, if you've got lots of honeybees raiding them as well, it can really impact them. Also, their hives are really dense. There's loads of them, which means things like diseases permeate a lot more quickly. And especially if you bring honeybees over from other countries, they might bring in diseases that impact our bumblebee populations. So in that sense, the honeybees are a real problem. But like I say, people also cultivate bumblebees as well.
I didn't know commercially reared bumblebees, and there's key reasons for commercial breeding. Obviously, effective pollination. Bumblebees are really efficient pollinators, and they pollinate some of our most important crops, tomato crops. Yeah. You wouldn't have tomatoes without honeybees, and blueberries and raspberries, all sorts of crops that they're so important for. But they get effective pollination with commercial breeding. The greenhouse cultivation, their effectiveness makes them ideal for greenhouse settings where they can replace labour-intensive manual pollination or hormonal treatments. Improved crop quality. Commercial bumblebees can lead to higher yields and better fruit quality for crops like tomatoes, raspberries and strawberries, and a very reliable and consistent service. Commercial breeding provides a consistent and reliable source of pollinators, which is especially important when natural populations are insufficient or weather conditions are unfavourable. However, those commercially reared bumblebees are causing problems. They are obviously competing now for food with the wild bumblebees, and they are also leading to a spread of diseases, which you've just alluded to
with the honeybees
earlier on. So as much as we are using them efficiently, they are causing a huge problem for wild bumblebees.
Yeah, and you have to think, and again, I haven't necessarily explored that in too much detail, the impact of the commercially reared bumblebees. But if they are bringing in big population of a certain species to pollinate a certain crop, then that will automatically shift the balance of the bumblebee populations from a nice mix of different species to favouring one. And again, that can especially if they're the sort of plants they visit, they do overlap because they're not like one plant per species. They have their preferred ones, but they still overlap. If you start shifting the balance, which we've spoken about loads before, it should be a nice ecosystem occupied with lots of different niches and lots of different species. If you throw loads of one species in there, it automatically disrupts the sort of natural order. The artificially or commercially reared bees are a surprising problem.
And also the other, the ones that we've talked about before, pesticides having a big problem, negatively affects colony development and size. So that's having a big issue.
Yeah, interestingly, so one of the big pesticides, big groups, which I think we would have spoken about, I think any insect episode we've done, would be the neonicotinoid. Hang on. I've said this word so many times for work, and I'm going to blame it on the fact it's nearly 8:30. Neonicotinoids, there we go. It's a group of pesticides that are particularly potent to a lot of really important pollinating insects. It contaminates pollen and nectar. It can reduce foraging, learning, colony growth, queen survival, all sorts. They are detrimental. And they have been heavily restricted for outdoor use across Europe and the UK, especially in 2018. But it was made so that they could only be used in emergency cases. And it was one this year in 2025 where I can't remember what crop it was, but a section of the agricultural industry made a case that they wanted to use the pesticides. And they thankfully were denied that ability. It wasn't allowed. But there is always that problem that they might come out and say, oh, we're having a really bad year. We need to implement these pesticides and then suddenly decimate our native pollinators. So it is still an ongoing problem. I mean, pesticides always are for insects.
Yes, of course. And, of course, climate change and extreme weather. You already said about 24 has been one of the worst seasons for bumblebees because we've had very wet spring and, all that stuff. And then we've had a very dry summer. So droughts, seasonal shifts in seasonal patterns and weather have been disrupting bumblebee behaviour and impact survival at key life stages such as spring emergence. And we had obviously a very, very wet spring.
Yeah, so we had a really short, wet, horrible spring, and it means that all the early queens come out and they can't establish their colonies properly.
And then when you get droughts caused by very dry periods, you have plants wither and die, so there's not as much nectar and pollen. So all of those things have affected.
Yeah, and sadly, they often go hand in hand, which we've had both this year. We had a wet, horrible spring, and then we've had a really dry, drought-heavy summer, and so that is the problem. And obviously, that then impacts year on year. If you don't have many queens surviving, the next year is not going to be able to recover quite so well.
Going back a little bit, this was a little bit of the research which I found interesting. Because obviously, bumblebee population on decline has been happening over a century. A major impact on bumblebees was caused by mechanisation of agriculture, accelerated by the urgent need to increase food production during the Second World War. So up until then, obviously used horse-drawn, ploughs and to till their fields and what have you. And the horses were fed on clover. And clover is a massive food source for bumblebees.
Yeah, I mentioned it for Bombus terrestris.
Yeah, so the farms then would provide flowering clover and flower-rich meadows, which favoured bumblebees, obviously, to feed the horses. And then mechanisation removed the need for horses, and most of the clover was obviously
it's not needed anymore.
Not
really,
needed, and they stopped growing the clover, and then artificial fertilizers came in, and then pesticides, etc.
Oh, that's really interesting.
So mechanization had a big effect on.
I've always really liked the idea of having a clover lawn.
When we did the No Mow May for the first time here, the amount of clover that came up in my lawn was incredible. And the amount of bees we had on the clover was incredible. So
I've seen people, as supposedly slightly less maintenance than a grass lawn, have a full and a full clover.
Often,
lawn.
If you just leave your normal lawn, you will get clover coming up in it because it's very
well. I have a little section on what people can do to help the bees towards the end.
So let's go on to the good news. And
thing worth mentioning is invasive species. So the Asian hornet, Vespa volutina, a huge wasp and really quite impressive, but not one we should be seeing in the UK. Their populations are growing, and generally if you see one, there is a place you can go to report, and they're dealt with quite quickly because it's considered quite an important thing to not let, we don't want them to spread at all. Yeah. But early sightings and some local breeding have started to pop up. You know, they're surviving slightly better with climate change, warming up sort of our region. And it's another concern. I would quite like to see an Asian hornet, but preferably over in Asia rather than in the UK.
They're huge, aren't they?
Yeah, they are very cool though. But okay, that's probably enough of the decline. Long story short, they're struggling, and the reports are coming out to show that as the weather changes in particular, there's risk of that getting worse.
Yeah, so let's move on to, I mean, the main conservation organisation really is the Bumblebee Conservation Trust. You've mentioned them earlier on. They started in 2006 by a bumblebee researcher called Dave Goulson. He founded it as a registered charity. And it was opened and started to prevent the extinction of any of the UK's bumblebees. In 2009 and 2010, they attempted to reintroduce the short-haired bumblebee, Bombus subterraneus, which had become extinct in Britain. They then partnered with Natural England and RSPB, of course, and they've reintroduced short-haired bumblebee queens from Skane in southern Sweden to restored flower-rich meadows at Dungeness in Kent. And there's been so many projects thereon since that was established.
The one I got, and we've spoken about the Back from the Brink projects before, because there are loads of them. But this one was for the Shill Garda Bee, which was a collaboration between, obviously, the Bumblebee Conservation Trust, but also Bug Life. And essentially, they were trying to secure the future of the Shill Garda Bee, which is one of our rarest in the UK. It ran from 2017 to 2021 in Somerset and Wiltshire. And essentially, it set up a bumblebee monitoring program. It also relied or involved lots of, like we said, flower-rich meadows and all sorts of things like that, established the current distribution in England. They provided habitat management advice to the land owners to make sure that the habitat connectivity could be improved. They engaged with local communities, and they also produced a species recovery plan for the Shill Garda Bee.
Yeah, actually, that's also part of one of their ongoing projects, which is making a buzz for the coast. Did you see that?
Yes, yeah, I did.
A project that spans 135 miles of Kent's coastline from Dartford to Deal, focusing on restoring and creating habitat for Kent's wild bees, especially the Shill Garda Bee. One of the primary aims of making a buzz for the coast will be to safeguard rare bee populations by creating and restoring habitat. We love anything that restores and creates new habitats. Linking isolated populations, we love anything that stops that fragmentation and tries to relink areas and habitats.
Yeah, we brushed over it quite quickly in the habitat decline bit because it's spoken about in every single episode, but the fragmentation is a really big problem for bumblebees, and so anything we can do to connect up their habitats is absolutely massive.
Absolutely, because that will also benefit so many other animals and insects and birds.
Yeah, and then one of their sort of absolute sort of poster boy schemes, and we alluded to already, is their bee walk.
Yes, the bee walk. In fact, I'm going to do one.
I think we should.
A bee walk because it looks amazing. Again, we love a citizen science project.
Any way that people can get involved in data collection and conservation is incredible. I mentioned that it opened in 2010. It was actually sort of established or active in 2008, but it opened to the public as a citizen science scheme in 2010. And it is just to try and collect abundance and distribution data on all of our British bumblebee and then use that data as widely as possible.
Yeah, we'll put a link onto their website, because go on to their website and read about Bee Walk and how you can get involved, because I'm definitely going to do it. It's easy to do.
Yeah, it's really cool. Essentially, volunteer bee walkers have a fixed transect that they walk once a month between March and October, and they record the abundance of every bumblebee species they see, and they submit all the data via their website. And what's really cool is the growth of this data set is basically created one of the largest bumblebee data sets in the world. And it's so important to the Trust's policy and advocacy work, as well as just the role that data plays in scientific research.
Yeah, and you haven't got to worry about, you may not be able to identify any of the bees, because they give you all the resources on the site to help you to do that. So, it's a real feel-good thing doing a bit of citizen science. I love it.
And just honestly, to give an example of what it can be used for, the researchers at the Bumblebee Conservation Trust, as well as the University of Edinburgh, and an institute that I can't pronounce, Karlsruhe Institute. I think that's how you say it. Essentially, have used the 10 years of bumblebee data collected by citizen scientists to provide the most detailed overview currently possible of bumblebee habitat requirements across the UK. And so the research has found a real range of differences between the various species and the types of habitat that they are associated with, which really sort of suggested that a one-size-fits-all approach to conservation for bumblebees will not protect all of the species. The efforts need to be carefully tailored to the different particular species. And so this study identified types of habitat that could be targeted. So arable areas were found to be really important for rare species like the large garden bumblebee, or Bombus ruderatus. I'm going to go with that, which is the largest species in the UK. Whereas big areas of semi-natural land like moorland were really important for species like the brown-banded carder bees and the bilberry bumblebee. And so they, by analysing this 10 years worth of data collected by citizen scientists, realised, you know, we can't just go, okay, cool, we'll do one type of habitat restoration, that will suit all the bees. But actually, in different regions, for different species, it needs a different approach.
That's how important citizen science is.
Otherwise, you risk pouring money, time, effort into putting loads of, I don't know, let's say arable land in one area, where actually that distribution is much more suited to a species that wants moorland or something like that.
It makes that data so crucial and so valuable, doesn't it?
But it's really nice to see all of this data collected by normal people getting involved in citizen science, used by scientists to be like, right, we can now use this to change the way that we protect our bumblebees and also change policy and everything like that. So
fantastic.
It really is.
I'm definitely going to do a bee walk.
Yeah, I think we should. I think it'd be really good.
There's another organisation called the World Bee Project. It's a community interest company, first independent initiative in the world that uses AI and advanced technologies to monitor pollinator and biodiversity declines from a global perspective to seek dynamic long-term solutions that benefit both nature and people. The World Bee Project also pioneers its environmental social impact programs to enable women farmers to restore declining bee populations while building sustainable livelihood options.
Oh, that's really cool.
So it's another really good project. I haven't read too much about it. I just saw a little link to it and went and had a little look. Through hands-on training in rearing declining indigenous honeybee species, women generate income by producing and selling honey. At the same time, they cultivate and plant trees, enhancing biodiversity, boosting pollinator populations, improving crop yields, and reducing environmental degradation and climate change.
That's a very good project
that I managed to find. So there's lots of little projects going on. The world's first bumblebee sanctuary was established at Vane Farm in Loch Leven National Nature Reserve in Scotland in 2008. And in 2011, London's Natural History Museum led the establishment of an international union for the conservation of nature bumblebee specialist group, chaired by someone called Dr. Paul H. Williams, assessing the threat status of bumblebee species worldwide using the Red List criteria. So, you know, a lot of people have got the bumblebees back. You know, there's a lot of people working out there, understanding the crucial need for conservation of the bumblebee.
Yeah,
it's an incredibly important animal for pollinating our crops. And obviously it's been recognised that it needs some help. And there are lots of organisations out there doing that. And there's lots of things that we can do as well, from the simple thing of planting nectar-rich plants.
Well, I've got a whole list of things.
Nectar-rich plants in your garden. We talked about that with rewilding your garden. We've talked about it many times.
Yeah, rewilding your garden was our very first episode. So if you go back, we probably sound quite different on different mics and far more nervous. But the information hopefully still stands up. But yes, we can obviously provide nectar-rich plants throughout the whole season, especially from early spring, which the queens really, really rely on. So plants that flower from March to October are vital. But you can also just make your garden or whatever space you have slightly more bee-friendly. You can leave some messy areas like long grass and leaf litter. Don't over-tidy in autumn or early springs because the queens will be hibernating.
You can put little bee and insect hotels in. I've done about five in my garden.
You can, like you mentioned about clover, but let the lawn sort of flower, get clovers, dandelions, buttercups, let them all bloom. You can also create or join a wildflower meadow like community garden and help look after that. Obviously, again, you've spoken about it for your own garden. Avoid pesticides and chemicals in the garden. I'm not going to try and pronounce the word again, but even bee safe ones or things that are marketed as bee safe aren't necessarily particularly safe. If you really need to apply them, make sure it's only in the evening.
You really don't. I've got so many flowers, plants, shrubs, roses. I've had them covered in aphid and black fly, and I haven't used any pesticides at all. I found that the hoverflies
and the sparrows
have come in and eaten an awful lot of the green fly and aphid.
Or was it the greenfinches? Something you told me.
It was the sparrows. And obviously hoverflies will come in and wasps come in.
And ladybirds.
And I've just taken a whole load of that stuff off with my fingers. You really don't need pesticides, and nature will look after itself. That's not to say you want, obviously, all your plants to be eaten and destroyed. You have to still look after them. But I do that just by my hands. I don't use any pesticides at all. I've had more bees.
You've had a lot of bees.
I know we've had a brilliant year for butterflies everywhere, actually. It's been a bumper year for butterflies, but we've had so many butterflies, but so many bees in our garden this year. And I've been gradually changing to more native plants as well. That's really important. If you can put native plants into your garden, the bees will come. So look out for, there's plenty of native wild flowers and nectar-rich plants that you can put in. Don't just go off and find anything you can. It's still beneficial, but if you can go native plants, that's even more beneficial. So I've been gradually changing my garden over as much as I can. I've put native trees in. Taken out a lot of the non-native ones that we see in the garden centres all of the time. Yeah. And there's plenty.
Yeah, you can also just
absolutely plenty.
You know, provide water is another big one, a shallow dish. You see it with butterflies a lot. It's got pebbles or marbles or something in there to allow them to get water and refuel. And a slightly different one, and one that requires a little bit more research, because I don't think there's like a nice certification, although obviously we know there are problems with certifications, but supporting farmers and food brands that use pollinator-friendly or regenerative farming practices is another big one.
That's a good shout.
So, you know, crop farmers and agricultural companies that are restoring hedgerows or keeping wildflower meadows or doing work to be regenerative.
And actually more and more farmers are jumping on board and doing that.
They are doing
really well in that respect.
I went to Groundswell, which is like a big agricultural festival for work, and it's all about regenerative agriculture, and the number of farmers there who are working really hard to leave wildflower meadows or look after land in a way that benefits insects and the rest of the wildlife. So if you can find, say, it requires a bit more in-depth research if you've got time, but if you can find brands and farms that are using these practices, then it's a nice way to sort of show support for that more environmentally
friendly way of
doing things, rather than one that's covered in pesticides or whatever. So that's another little thing to do. And obviously, finally, you can support bumblebee conservation groups like the Bumblebee Conservation Trust. Bug Life and Wildlife Trusts are another one, or other ones, but I would say Bumblebee Conservation Trust are the name for looking after our bumblebees, but also are perhaps in need of a little bit more help. They're not quite as big as like the Wildlife Trust. So if you do fancy supporting a group, I would really recommend the Bumblebee Conservation Trust. They do incredible work. They're really, really brilliant. Their website's full of information. We'll obviously leave lots of links. So if it's something you're interested in doing, they're a great place to show support.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm definitely going to add another sticker to my car to support them. I already do. Actually, the Wildlife Trust are really good. Sussex Wildlife Trust had a huge resource on protecting bumblebees. So the Wildlife Trusts themselves are very good. But this is a very specific group. This is
it?
A trust that needs help, and that a trust that obviously is trying to help save the bumblebee in this country, and it's hugely important.
Obviously, showing support through donations or becoming a member is massive, but you can also become a citizen scientist or take part in the bee walk. You can also look out for, like, sign up to their newsletter and look out for campaigns where they're trying to push for better road verge management or wildflower planting or pesticide reduction. You can sign their petitions and support the campaigns as well. So it's not necessarily all about financial support, but just supporting their work wherever you can.
Yeah, and I don't know whether, did you mention flowers? You did, didn't you? So you can plant flowers such as red clover, lavender, snapdragons, runner beans, salvias, borage, Cosmos, Lungwort, and Comfrey are all things that the bumblebee absolutely
where
loves.
Where was that information 2 minutes ago? No, we've gone past the plants, moved on to the supporting conservation trust. You just throw us right back in.
Yeah, I get criticised for that. I suddenly go, oh, I forgot to do that bit.
But yes, you can also plant all those things.
And then you haul me back into life.
Like, hang on, we were wrapping up beautifully.
It's just that I got to the end and I suddenly realised I hadn't mentioned...
worked my way through it all.
I'm sorry, do you want to cut that out?
No, it's fine, leave it. It's fine. I'll let you off. Because it's advice I wouldn't be able to give because I don't know.
After every episode, your mum says that. Your mum says, do you know what, Matthew's really good at pulling the whole episode back into some kind of order because you then go off on one.
Well, on that note...
on that note, we're going to leave you.
Thank you for
Hope
listening.
You enjoyed listening about the bumblebee as much as we did.
Yeah,
the
I feel
research.
Like this has been quite a jovial episode. Maybe it's because we're recording late at night, but I say late, it's nearly 9 o'clock. But I hope you've enjoyed listening. Obviously, we'll leave all the links to everything we've spoken about in the show notes. Go follow us over on Instagram at the Birdie Bug Pod. Drop us a message. You've got a cool bumblebee photo, send it our way because that'd be lovely. And otherwise, we'll see you in the next episode.
Yes, thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Bye.
Bye bye.